Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How close is your family to falling below the poverty line? Many of us who earn middle-class salaries feel pretty secure. As long as we're working, we can pay for housing, transportation, food, and even a few extras now and then. But a new report from the Corporation for Enterprise Development finds that half of Texas households overall live in a state of persistent financial insecurity, meaning that any interruption in that regular income or any expensive family emergency could push them below the poverty line. And that includes 32% of households earning between $54,000 and $90,000 a year. Andrea Levere joins us to talk about that as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. She is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, which has just released its 2014 Assets and Opportunity Scorecard online. You can read it in its entirety at cfed.org. Andrea, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Texas overall gets a D grade for financial assets and income. Our poverty rate is higher than the national average, and 49.8% of Texas households are categorized as living in liquid asset poverty. Can you explain that term for us?
Absolutely. It starts from our view that it's not just what you earn, it's also what you own. And that to really understand how we build financial security and economic opportunity in this country, we have to look at income and we have to look at assets. And so to get that full picture, especially given what happened to so many families during the recession, last year we created this new measure called liquid asset poverty. And it's a very simple measure. It just looks at the household balance sheet, and it looks at your liquid assets, not your home or your car, which you couldn't access in the short term, and says, do you have enough to exist at the poverty level for 3 months if your main source of income is disrupted? And as you said so eloquently earlier, the numbers are stunning. In Texas, it's 50%. And in the United States as a whole, it's 44%. And these are numbers that people experience themselves, but they don't see themselves as part of this larger group. And that's been what's made the news around this so significant.
How could this have snuck by so many of us who are actually in this situation?
Because almost all the data that's collected around poverty is based on the income poverty measure. And it's really only been over the last two decades in the United States that people have begun to understand how assets are so critical in our broader financial security equation. There's very few sources of data that the federal government collects that actually looks at household net worth and household balance sheet, whereby there's multiple sources of data that look at income.
So we know that unemployment is higher. Rates tend to be higher among very young workers. And perhaps not surprisingly, liquid asset poverty is also heavily concentrated among households headed by younger workers. Can you talk about why young people are at greater risk?
Well, that's a really excellent question. One of the issues that we've looked at connected to the data is how well do we build financial knowledge and financial capability, and how well do we provide structures that support people in saving? One of the things I think about all the time is, despite spending every day working on these issues, if my retirement savings weren't automatically taken out of my paycheck, who knows what my retirement savings would look like? So if we look at younger people, and we look at the fact that many of them are in workplaces that don't support, through auto enrollment or other things, them starting to save for retirement or other reasons, we see, in fact, that they don't have the support structures they need to start looking this way. And that's a big piece of the scorecard itself. It speaks to what are the policies that we could implement that help address these issues.
Things as simple as encouraging all employers to use direct deposit of paychecks seem to be stressed here. Why is that such a big deal?
Oh, that's such a great point. One of my favorite advocates, the treasurer of the city of San Francisco, Jose Cisneros, mm-hmm. often says the worst thing you could do to an unbanked person is to give them a check. And the issue there is we also have another very powerful data point that a person who is unbanked, on average, spends $1,000 a year on financial services, whether that's fees paid to the check casher or excess interest rates to the predatory lender. It's money that they can ill afford and could be used to much better purpose. So one of the areas that we really highlight on the Texas profile is looking at how do you address the very high percentage of unbanked households. Texas ranks 50, and underbanked households, which means you may have an account, but you don't really use it. You also use alternative lenders. And giving household savings accounts. Only 63% of Texas families have a savings account.
What keeps people from having a bank account, a savings account, or a checking account? Because I think for some people listening, this might be a familiar issue. And for others, they cannot conceive sort of living in the financial world without, at the very least, having a checking account.
This question has almost as many answers as there are people. But let me give you a few. And this is, I think, particularly relevant to Texas. Many immigrants come from countries where the management of the financial institutions was not good, to say the least. So they come with a mistrust of financial institutions. Secondly, many of the product terms are not really workable for low-income people, although the good news is that much of that has changed, particularly on the overdraft side. So, in fact, if you were a low-income person with an account that was subject to high overdraft fees, we used to call this the $42 cup of coffee,
right?
It would be a rational thing for you to go to check casher because you knew there wasn't going to be any surprises. You may be paying a lot, but there was no surprises. And then third, it's become increasingly difficult in many neighborhoods to find a branch or to find places that they can bank. Now, the good news is that we now have many financial institutions who see that this is a big market. And the data point I shared before about what people are paying for alternative financial services, well, that's powerful data to show that there's a business case for bank accounts and customer development. So we've been very pleased with the number of financial institutions that have created accounts that work for lower income people. And one of the things I want to add here, it's not like people are looking for things that are free. The issue we have found with low income consumers is they just want certainty. So if there is a $5 fee a month, as long as it stays five, that's something they can plan around.
Predatory lenders are a big concern here and throughout the report. First of all, talk about what falls under that umbrella and then how lower-income people in particular tend to get trapped in these cycles.
Mm-hmm. So I think we all were introduced to this with the mortgage issue and the mortgage and foreclosure crisis. And I will say and take full responsibility that many of us who work in this field did not pay as much attention as we should have to how important protecting consumers were from these types of products. So it began really with looking at mortgage loans and trying to regulate them so they were fair and affordable. Then it moved into consumer lending, both short-term and longer-term consumer lending. And we've seen significant activity at the state level to regulate payday loans, check cashers, and other things. But this industry is very creative, and there's all sorts of other ways, auto title loans and other things that have come up to replace some of the products that have been regulated. So a key priority for us in the scorecard that you can see in our list of policies is a set of policies that really provide transparency and protections around all sort of predatory debt. But at the same time, Chris, we have to make sure there's high-quality products that are available in the community. There was one state that outlawed predatory lending, but there was no alternative, and so people just found other ways to get into those businesses. So I think there's two sides of this coin of how we need to make sure we have the right products so so that then they can replace those that don't build financial security.
Have there been experiments anywhere, Andrea, for, say, credit unions or regular savings and loan type institutions to provide the kinds of microloans that sometimes a low-income customer might simply need to tide them over for the next 10 days and then could repay if the rate of interest were not exorbitant?
Excellent question. That is what I'd say is kind of the next area of innovation. What we find is a range of CDFIs, which are community development financial institutions that are credit unions or also loan funds, have been experimenting with a set of products that not only can meet these key financial needs, but also can be financially sustainable. So we see several organizations around the country that are doing this, both in lending circles, where you have a group of consumers working together, and also through credit unions and some community development banks. The other area that I'm sure you're familiar with is the explosion of online products. One of the interesting pieces of data is that individuals of color are using online financial tools at an even greater rate than the white communities. And so there is a really important piece here about how do we make online banking and mobile banking and other products that can meet a financial need in a good way available more broadly. And then, this is the other big challenge, how do we then connect having a prepaid card, which you can use for basic transactions, to then developing a savings account and then adding on more products. So how do we move people along the continuum of financial capability?
Why are these problems more pronounced in families of color as a whole than they are among white families?
Well, I think we go back hundreds of years to explicit policies that we had that excluded households of color. Mm-hmm. So I think, for example, of the policy that had the biggest impact on my family, which was the GI Bill. So my father, who grew up in a lower middle class household in Brooklyn, was able to go to an excellent public university, and then for which he paid very little, and then he used the GI Bill to go to medical school. That made all the difference. Yet at the same time, those very institutions were not accepting students of color. Or people use the GI Bill to finance mortgages on their first home purchase. Yet at the same time, people of color were completely restricted from moving in to those neighborhoods. One of the most fascinating statistics that I've learned is that the Homestead Act, if you go way back in your American history, which is when they gave Americans a certain amount of land, if they would settle that land, one out of four white households can trace their household wealth back to the Homestead Act.
Wow.
Which is astonishing. So the thing we have to understand is what is the long-term impact of those policies? One of the things we've seen time and time again as people debate the estate tax is the best way to be financially secure is to inherit it. But if your parents and grandparents were excluded from the opportunities to build wealth, well, you're not really going to inherit anything.
Andrea Levere is with us. She's president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, which has just released its 2014 Assets and Opportunity Scorecard. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrea Levere. She's president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development. You can read the 2014 Assets and Opportunities Scorecard online at cfed.org. We're talking to Andrea today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org, sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or calling 1-800-933-5333. Andrea, I was astonished to read 65% of Texans have subprime credit ratings. How does that affect financial stability overall?
I'm so glad you asked me that. Because, in fact, as we know, your credit score is your entryway into the whole economy. So as we see today, your credit score can determine if you can rent an apartment. It determines if you can get a job, and then it determines what the cost of credit is. So earlier you asked me, what's the connection between liquid asset poverty number and ongoing financial insecurity? And the most dramatic connection that we make is the subprime credit score, because if, in fact, you don't have enough savings to deal with a crisis for 3 months, where are you going to go? You're going to go try to find some short-term debt that can tide you over. And if, in fact, you can only qualify for subprime debt on predatory terms, that's not really going to help you move up or even stay at the same place. It's going to dig you deeper down into this level of financial insecurity. And unfortunately, that what we've seen with the best of intentions of folks trying to make it happen to too many families.
I understand the reasons why financial institutions would want to reward the sort of best qualified consumers, but it is ironic that the less you need the help, the better rate you get.
Right. And you've probably seen the multiple studies on the high cost of being poor. And we see this everything from what groceries cost in low-income communities to other things where you actually pay a premium if you're poor over what other people would pay either way. And I think that that really goes back to our fundamental view that we need to build the building blocks of financial security and the basic structure, or we like to say plumbing, that puts people on a road to financial security that then can take them out of these traps that subprime credit can cause.
So the average credit card debt revolving in North Texas as of 2012, at least, was upwards of $7,000, which, of course, would take years to pay off unless we're sending in well beyond the monthly minimum payments. I mean, if somehow everybody were to come into $7,000, could we fix a lot of these problems, or is it does it go deeper than that immediate amount of cash?
Well, I think it's related, but critical. So one of the things that determines both your level of financial security and your ability to look ahead, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is your sense of the resources you have available for the future. So the issue with this credit card debt is critical in the sense that to solve that problem, you need to do two other things. You need to be able to look at your whole household and think about how money comes in and money goes out, and what the opportunities are to then begin to save and save your way out of that. Number two, you need to have the right products to be able to do this, as we talked about before. The will alone is not going to get you there. Mm. If you don't have the right kind of savings account and checking account, you then are not going to have the ability to pay off that debt above and beyond your day-to-day expenses.
So building financial security overall requires this three-pronged approach, right? We need sufficient income in order to save money. We can, in turn, invest to build assets. And then asset ownership turns out to be a driver of income. And it almost goes in a circle.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have a household financial security framework that we share, particularly with people who are coming to this field for the first time. And income and then savings, and then investment are three pieces, but also learning and protection are part of that. So it's almost like a virtuous circle of these five elements that can, working together, make all the difference. And I think the other key issue here is what's important is to start where a person is. So if their main issue is dealing with their credit score, then we start with that even before we start them saving along the way. And by building them up step by step, it helps do exactly what you said. And it's the opposite of the high cost of being poor. It's really the flip side of that, which you've probably heard, is the only time you can get a loan is when you don't really need it.
Right. Andrea, I think we all understand that property and investments count as economic assets. You also consider education to be an economic asset, even though we can't necessarily account for it on a balance sheet.
I think the issue of the day is human capital. And how do we develop human capital over time? If you were to say, what is spearheading the growth of the U.S. economy and who are going to be the winners, it's going to be those who have the right human capital to meet the needs of the labor market and elsewhere. And that's why one of the biggest areas CFPB focuses on is children's savings accounts. On average, 8% of low-income students graduate college by their mid-20s. And in many ways, the systems that we've developed to help people graduate college, and a lot of them are wonderful, are just not sufficient for today. So one of my favorite stories is I gave a lecture at Harvard around children's savings accounts, and the head of the United Negro College Fund came up to me and said, "You are the answer to my problem." He says, "I have over $1 billion in scholarships, but scholarships alone don't work as effectively as we wish. We get to the kids too early. Many students are dropping out not because they're not prepared, but because of the financial insecurity of their families. And," he said, "they don't have real efficacy in the decision-making process." So we've created a partnership to pair children's savings with scholarships and academic counseling. And one of the key things we've discovered through the excellent work of several researchers is how powerful having savings is, both on your aspirations for college and then actually on your going to college and graduating. We have one study that cites that among students who expected to go to college, those with at least $500 in savings were 6 times as likely as those without to go to college.
Is it appropriate, Andrea, to keep those savings sort of legally sacrosanct and earmarked only for education, or does it make sense for lower-income families to be allowed, if they're about to lose their home, which would be very traumatic for a child growing up like that, to be able to dip into that? And where how do we decide the line on these things?
Well, you know, it's impossible to decide it for other people.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we have done is be very explicit about the purpose of different savings. So we have been doing for 2 decades match savings programs for adults, and for the past decade, match savings for children. We find among the consumers of these products that they love the fact that it's restricted, because the minute they're saving, they get all sorts of requests for loans or money from their friends and their family. And it gives them great comfort that that piece is protected. But that doesn't mean that they also don't need a short-term or emergency savings product to help with those short-term issues that can end up being so critical if you don't have those resources. So it really goes to what are the set of products that every household needs to prosper, and how do we make sure we provide them to lower-income households in the same way we have them for middle- and upper-income households.
We've seen that home ownership is deeply correlated to long-term financial security, but I'm wondering if owning a home is a cause of that security or the effect of it.
In this country, we have provided the most financial and tax incentives towards home ownership of any other asset-building use. And we are still of the belief, despite the crisis over the last several years, that home ownership done right, and that I mean with non-predatory, high-quality debt, with some savings and cushion along the way, with the right kind of homeownership counseling, is a very important asset or wealth creation strategy. But it's not for everyone. And I think there's many households for whom long-term, permanently affordable renting can be just as valuable. So I think for us, it's really thinking about what does the new portfolio look like? How do we do home ownership for those for whom it is the right option, and how do we do it well? And for those for whom home ownership is not the right option right now, how do we help them build assets otherwise so they can move along towards greater financial security?
So how effective are opt-out programs for automatic savings, say from job income? Do they work to help people really grow their savings?
Oh, they're incredibly effective. I mean, I just used myself as an example earlier in this interview. Mm-hmm. I think that we all know that automatic defaults, from everything we know about behavioral science, is the way to go. If you don't have to make a conscious decision and it's done for you, it's a very powerful tool. I don't know who actually said that an inertia is the most powerful force in the universe, but I think many of us would agree. And I think that part of this is that we really want to be able to offer these products across the income spectrum. We heard in the State of the Union last week of a new initiative to help build small savings called MyRA. And I was just on a call getting briefed on this today, and it's really about how do we provide the auto-enrollment option for people who are now not covered by any plan by their employer so they can begin that habit over time. There's very powerful research about how the changing habits change behavior and then change outcomes. And so there's a set of behavioral insights that I think have gone already a long way. I don't have the exact statistic, but there's very powerful data about what's happened in large companies when they switched from opt-in to opt-out.
Is there evidence, often we hear the advice that people should start saving if they haven't been in the habit, even if it's a really ultimately a small amount, something like $10 a week. Is there evidence, Andrea, that when people do that, that ultimately that habit pushes them to put away more when they're in a position to do so?
There's two parts to that, right? There's first, how do you get people used to doing something on a regular basis? So I'll give you a wonderful example. One of the first universal children's savings programs in the United States was started in San Francisco. It's called K2C, or Kindergarten to College. And when they first began, they provided match for savings for the families. Very soon after, though, they said, what we really want is to get these families saving regularly, so let's give them something called a save steady bonus. So if they save for 6 months in a row, they get a special bonus on top of that. And this is turning out to be a very strong motivator to get people in the savings habit. One of the most powerful results of savings is something we call the assets effect, which is really being able to have hope for the future. And small amount of savings, while people can say, oh, that'll never get the person to college, or that'll never get them here or there, I can't overestimate the value of having that. And people understanding that they can do it for the first time, and then building savings habits that can grow larger and also can be part of more broad incentives.
Should we make it easier for people to automatically take their tax refund and not spend it at the sporting goods store or with a Walmart gift card, but to put it directly into an investment account?
Yes, and this is an area where we have some great experience. There is the option to do a split refund so that you can split your refund at the time that you get it and therefore take some for today and save some for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. CFPB has done some very interesting behavioral research around this to try to figure out how can we encourage people to do this more. And a little experiment we did was really fascinating. Most of what we've discovered is by the time people get to the VITA site or the free tax prep site, wherever they're going, they've already spent their money in their head. So it's really hard to change it then.
Mm-hmm.
So we discovered if we sat down with them, even just the day before, and we said, here are the options, write down on a piece of paper how you'd like to split your refund. They would then go in and had a much higher rate of actually putting some aside for savings. And one of my favorite phrases always is, no is simply a response to the unexpected.
Hmm.
So really helping people think about that beforehand has been very critical in having them take advantage of the split refund. And your point is double here. It goes back to your point about auto-enrollment, because what's so great about tax time is for many low-income families, it's the most money they're going to see the entire year at one time. And number two, it can be done automatically, so there isn't a whole set of other steps they have to take to be able to save.
We have an email here from Denise who says, can you talk about educating about savings in African-American homes? When I grew up, my mom had no knowledge of saving for retirement. Everything I have learned now, I had to learn on my own.
Well, you know what? I don't think that's unique to African-American families. I think that's very, very common to families across the board. And what we do know is that children learn absolutely from watching their parents. At the same time, and this is why we find children's savings accounts so powerful, is that parents will do for their children what they won't do for themselves.
Hmm.
So one of the things we've watched with the children's savings programs is as we get accounts for the children, the parents, who many of whom are unbanked, will suddenly decide that they need to get a bank account. And then, in order for them to save, back to your point of $5, $10 a month, which is really all we expect, they then have to think about, how am I going to do that, and how am I going to plan for saving?
Andrea Levere is with us. She's president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development. If you'd like to join us for this One Crisis Away conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, Andrea Levere. The corporation has just released its 2014 Assets and Opportunities Scorecard. You can read the whole thing online at cfed.org. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Andrea, as we said in the very top of the hour, Texas ranks 41st out of 50 in state policies adopted to assist people who are struggling financially. Can you talk about some of the ways that Texas seems to be trailing other states in terms of policies to ensure financial stability?
Absolutely. I think one of the places we often start just has to do with the level of wages. So a basic policy we look at for every state is, has the state enacted a minimum wage requirement that is either higher than the federal wage level or indexed to inflation? And we don't see that in Texas. A second area that we discussed earlier before is, has the state enacted an earned income tax credit? One of the very effective policies we've seen is when a state will piggyback on the federal earned income tax credit, and that enables a family significantly that's working to then move into a much more financially secure situation. So those are kind of two of the very baseline policies. The next level goes back to the conversation we had about people being banked. And one of the areas that we see great progress in is creating programs. They're named bank-on programs that offer low-income or unbanked people starter accounts that are very effective. What I love about this program is that it's a way for financial institutions to really work collaboratively with the community, and it's a way for them to get new customers with support from nonprofit organizations that are helping them build their financial knowledge and financial capability. So that's another area, particularly given the statistics that I shared earlier, that could be a relatively easy, nothing's easy, of course, but straightforward way we could go. And then as we look in the education area and the conversation we had earlier around education, I think providing more incentives to help people save for college is just a huge win-win. We partner with two organizations in Texas, Raise Texas and the Center for Public Policy Priorities, who've been real leaders nationally in working on policies that can help incent students to go to college and help increase their savings. So I just think this is a very big area for the state.
These two things are not obviously mutually exclusive, but is there a benefit to simply investing more at the state level in public education, public higher education, as opposed to encouraging individuals to save for college? So in other words, you know, when 25 years ago the state was putting in $4 for every dollar that a student spent, and now it's well under a dollar, that makes college more expensive no matter how much one has saved.
That is absolutely right, and I'm sure you've seen the stories all over the country. You know, the University of California flagship schools, the cost to go to a school like Berkeley is now almost equal to a private Ivy League school. So that opportunity has been one of the strongest asset-building opportunities, in my view, in the United States, is having the cost of a high-quality college education be affordable. And it has outstripped the household's ability to pay, and that has led, of course, concurrently, to the very significant increase in college debt. Overall, nationally in the scorecard, we saw that the rate of college attendance and graduation was increasing, but also the rate of debt alongside it.
Back for just a minute to the issue of the earned income tax credit on a state level. How would that work in a state like Texas that does not levy a personal income tax?
Well, typically it is piggybacks on the federal earned income tax credit, and you can make it refundable based on a certain percentage. So I don't quite know what the mechanics of that would be, but we think it's possible. The state of Washington, which also doesn't have an income tax, was able to create an earned income tax credit that piggybacked on the federal credit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rhonda. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for this program. I just wanted to give a hearty endorsement to the idea of systematic savings, even if it's on a small basis. I was thinking about this morning when someone she said, you're just a housewife. I do stay at home, and I have taken care of my husband and my children, but I also have a small business. But what really got me was the idea of the MyIRA and the fact that it's geared toward, you know, lower-income people. But, you know, it runs it through your work environment. But for those of us who stay at home and work at a home, you know, there is no systematic program. But what I did nearly 10 years ago after watching my sister, who was now younger than I am at this point, you know, pass away, and she did not have any savings, and it was really a strain on the family. And then 15 months later, a second sister and I, it just kind of woke me up that I needed to start really thinking about a saving plan for me, even as a housewife, as a stay-at-home mom. So at that same time, an investment advisor along with an investment company partnered together and offered that incentive so that if you save $50 a month at the end of 12 months, they would match it. And I became so excited about the idea of saving on my own that I did whatever I could to come up with that $50 every month because it was in developing the habit of saving. So at the end of 12 months, I was able to have that $600, and I got the bonus of $100. And Just from that $700, I was able to start a small business, and it has become, you know, very successful in the area that I'm in.
Well, Rhonda, that sounds like a wonderful success story, and I'm so glad you called to share that. Andrea, is there any comment that you'd like to make?
I just want to take Rhonda on the road with me. That is just fabulous, and I think it builds in each element. What motivated you to begin saving, right? You saw what happens when you're not taking care of yourself in that way, in a very personal way, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Two, it spoke to some of the challenges that self-employed people have in trying to get access to accounts and account structures and our need to provide those broadly to everyone who wants to save. And then it talked about how do you use an incentive. That incentive, Rhonda, wasn't that big, but boy, it made a huge difference for you, didn't it?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Rachel in Houston. Hello, Rachel.
Hi. Hi, Andrea. I actually have a friend who works for a financial stability program for the United Way and actually works for CFED now. And we've actually had a lot of conversations about the work that you guys do. So I wanted to say thank you, first of all, for that. And I'm actually a product of a low-income family. I come from a low-income family. And I was just curious what you guys are doing or what other nonprofits are working towards, maybe perhaps lobbying the government to install some sorts of programs within high schools and colleges to educate low-income families. Because for somebody who is, I'm college-educated now, and I started, like I said, low-income. Now I'm middle-income, but previously I had no knowledge on, you know, 401k, savings, any of that, as you stated, is typical. So I was just curious what you guys are doing to promote that in the high schools or in the college universities, because I think, based off my conversations with her and other people, that that might be something that really is going to help those people, you know, save more and help folks who come from low-income families to understand the financial impact of, you know, student loans and so on and so forth. And
thanks for your call, Rachel.
Rachel, that's a fabulous question. And I'll say two things, which is in the broad way, one of the things CFED has done is to help organize a national network of organizations called the Assets and Opportunity Network, which are now operating in 40 states, that bring together the full range of practitioners and policymakers and service providers to both improve the delivery of products and services in this area and advocate for policy. Much of that policy is focused on educational access and educational success. So in that degree, we are working more actively with universities, schools, and others. At the same time, we have been working with the Department of Education at the national level to think about how we marry long-term vital programs like Pell Grants and others with savings and financial education that can really strengthen a family's ability to plan, just like Rachel mentioned. And I think one of the issues that we all agree on is you have to start much earlier than high school or even 11th grade when people are first planning to go to college, because that both sets up expectations, but it sets up the knowledge base you need to prepare yourself.
We have an email here from Allison in Richardson who says, I don't think it's the government's responsibility to help me or anyone else save. It is my responsibility. It seems like this is just another way for the government to expand into our lives. Plus, I feel like this type of program leads to a deterioration of personal responsibility. Will you speak to that?
So my view of this issue is really one based on fairness. CFED published several years ago a report called Upside Down, the $400 billion asset building budget. And we looked at all the ways that the U.S. government supports asset building, whether it's through home ownership or retirement accounts or small business development or education. And what we discovered is that the lion's share of this go to the middle and upper class households, and less than 4% of that budget went to the bottom 60% of the income distribution. And my view here is that we're missing out on enormous amount of productive capacity for the broader economy by not providing the same structures and incentives that we routinely provide for middle and upper class folks for lower-income families who can use it so much more. So what we have seen is that there's very, very few people we've come across who don't see the opportunity, like we heard earlier from Rhonda, of once they had a structure and an ability, didn't do everything in their power to save. And in ways, what I see is providing the infrastructure and the incentive really ignites personal responsibility in a way that people don't have when they're feeling hopeless or with a sense of real insecurity.
So it sounds like, you know, what you're saying is that if we have the mortgage interest deduction on the home that we own because we're middle class or above, if we have tax-deferred savings accounts, those are, in effect, they are money from the government, but most of us don't view them that way when we receive these benefits.
I know, and that's the big light bulb, isn't it? You know, not only do we have the deduction on our own home, we have our deduction on our second home if we have one of those. So in my view, you know, what is the most productive way to incent people to build assets in a way that's much more equitable? How do we take the things that really did work? How did we take the mortgage interest deduction, which really has worked, and say, okay, let's provide a refundable savers credit for low-income people? We now have a savers credit, very important, but it's only deductible. So if you don't have a tax liability, it's not worth anything to you. Let's make it refundable, and suddenly we'll have more Rhondas in the world.
Texas does pride itself on being a state with a business-friendly climate. Did you find that this is a good place in which to start up a new enterprise?
So interestingly, we found that for micro-enterprises, Texas ranked 11th. But for small business ownership, Texas ranked 48. So you see in those numbers a really interesting contradiction of, for very small businesses, it's a quite good environment. But for, you know, the definition of a small business using the SBA is up to 500 employees. For those larger small businesses, you're actually almost at the very bottom.
So are things looking up since the economy has picked up after the fallout in 2008?
Yes, and I think one of the things that the scorecard shows in terms of the data nationally is that we are seeing improvement on the broader economic indicators.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment rates are falling, foreclosure rates are falling, the average amount of credit card debt is falling, all really positive. But we find that household economic security hasn't budged at all. So while the macroeconomic factors are showing improvement, we still have a lag in terms of households. And all the articles we see in terms of what encourages people to invest and grow require that the households feel optimistic about the future, just like the broader economics.
Andrew Levere is president of the Corporation for Enterprise Development. You can read the 2014 Assets and Opportunity Scorecard online at cfed.org. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Andrea Levere joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. The show is produced by Stephen Becker, with Lindsay Connect as assistant producer and Jeff Whittington as executive producer. Shelley Canavy is our engineer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.